Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June the 13th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Andy Gordon. Today's session number is 2002, and it's titled Technology and Progress, the Promise and the Peril. Technology and Education, Are We Better Off? Let's listen in.
Technology-related issues yesterday and got more technical than people were expecting, I think, or than I'll ever get again. So there are very few of those concepts I want to revisit. But there was one, because it's a bridge to the rest of what I hope to have us talk about, that I want to get back on the board. And it's the concept of fidelity. Because fidelity and being faithful is not a concept that's just used in the technical world, but in the religious world. And it's an interesting one to think about because it's so easy to conceive of in technical terms. In technical terms, faithfulness just means a precise rendition of something so that it sounds like, at the end of the process, what it did at the beginning. So you get as much noise out of the system as you can. And what you're always doing is increasing the signal-to-noise ratio. That means that if I have mic'd an oboe and set it out over a CD, then by the time it comes out of a speaker, it should sound like the oboe as if I were in the room sitting next to the instrument. So it's interesting. In technical terms, it's very easy to precisely define what it means to be faithful. And in fact, I think the fact that it's easy to do is one of our problems, as we'll see. And it's also why it's possible to make statements like that. It's only possible to say things like, to err is unlikely, to forgive unnecessary, when you know precisely what you want to achieve and how to get there. I think our challenge increasingly is, with respect to some other goal, how do we remain faithful amidst technology? As some people have said, if you don't know where you're going, any path will do. Most of the technology people know exactly where they're going. It's gonna get faster and cheaper. And it's become more embedded in our everyday lives. And a chunk of the action is going to be available. No matter what we think we do that can't be represented technically, their job is to explain to us and get us to accept that it can, that the technical rendition is sufficient. And I want to visit that concept in a variety of ways in education today, and to try to get us to think about what it is we're trying to achieve with education, and whether technology is helpful with respect to those goals. Because in the absence of our positive, affirmative declaration of what we're trying to achieve, something seductive happens with technology. And what education becomes is what technology does. So all of a sudden, we come to understand that limited, narrow vision of what we meant by education becomes what it is we can do with computers. Now you can think about that already in large terms, in the way budgets are spent. Our president has declared, and you can't find a congressperson that will disagree with him, that every school must be wired, and everybody must have an email address, because we are not serving people sufficiently if those goals aren't achieved. Now, in most schools where technology has come in the door, it's been at the expense of something, because the budgets aren't full enough. We all know what's happening to levies in cities and how much people are willing to spend in order to keep the schools going well. Since the levies aren't going up proportionally to the expenses, and since we're insisting on computerization, it means that an ever larger proportion of the money is being spent on technology. It seems to me that those proportions are large enough now that it's perfectly reasonable to ask, are we getting the bang for our buck? And you can't talk about bang for the buck without talking about what's the signal and what's the noise. So I want us to think a little about what's the signal in education and what's the noise. Because I think technology as often contributes to the noise as to the signal in a variety of ways. And we don't notice it because we accept the logic that we must have these machines in order to be fully enfranchised for the 21st century. And I say this with great guilt. I am among the people that are imposing technology on the world, much of which I think is valuable. I mean, I think we don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but we do have to examine the circumstances of the imposition. I know that I've been doing this long enough that I've worked with Apple when they sort of governed the world of education, and with a very clever strategy, Jobs had persuaded everybody that computers were necessary in education. And an interesting thing happened. We passed through two or three generations of machines that nobody even remembers anymore, the Apple IIs in various varieties, and they never quite delivered. They never quite did what we expected them to do. People were never learning as effectively as it was argued they'd be able to learn. And the argument was always, well, it's the next generation of equipment that's going to do it. You just got to get it in the door, begin to learn how to use it, and whatever's coming next, that's going to solve whatever those problems. Those are merely technical, mechanical problems that can be solved through greater engineering and through your greater investment in this technology. Now, again, having gone down that path for so long, I think that the argument can now be parsed. Because I think the success stories aren't, in almost any other field, we would require by this time evidence of success. True evidence of success that things had changed for the better in order for investments to continue at the rate they are. And absent the evidence that most of us would require, it's not only the case that the investments continue, but now the universal claim is made. Every school must be on the internet. Everybody must have access to technology. Every student must be conversant with the technology. It's going to improve the way education is, our education event is delivered, and also improve the lives outside of the classroom of all the people to whom technology is being addressed. So let's think about that a little bit, and with some examples. As Gaylor was talking earlier, there were two stories that occurred to me. One of them is something about efficiency. Gaylor gave this wonderful example of where he had everybody sit down, pair up in this room, and ask embarrassing questions of one another. Get embarrassing information without asking the embarrassing question. So people were paired into ones and twos. And he was trying to get people to ask things like, did the other person brush their teeth this morning without asking? And let's push it a little further, did they have a bowel movement? Can you get that information without asking directly? When it was over, he wasn't so interested in whether we got the answer. He was interested in the conversation that was held on the way to getting the information. So if you actually wanted the answer to that information, it was a very inefficient process we were involved in, with a lot of side conversations that didn't seem to be about the event. But when it was over, we might not have known the answer to the question, but we knew the person we were paired up with much better than we did coming in the room. So the efficiency question, which is also asked with respect to technology, is efficiency with respect to what goal? What are we trying to achieve here? And I want to sort of hold that up for us to think about. The final thing that occurred to me like this is how in the community organizing experience I was involved in Chicago, where they were trying to make tremendous improvements on the South Side. There was one organization, I don't want to actually get into names now, but there was one organization that did an awful lot of work, drew an awful lot of private money in, and held a meeting every year to say how they were doing. And it was soon after I arrived in Chicago that I went to the first meeting, the first annual meeting, and all these people were sitting being asked to give more money. And the organization said, the organization head stood up and said to everybody, this is fantastic what we're achieving here. We're actually able to employ a lot of people. For example, there's this plastics factory in our neighborhood that we have opened and is employing about 30 people. Came back the next year, and they said, we continue to do a great job in our neighborhood in community economic development. For example, there's this plastics factory in the corner over here that employs, 25 to 30 people. And I came the third year, and there was this plastics factory. So this one example was held up as if we were to make the leap that everything larger than what you could ever achieve in that one little factory was being achieved. I think that often happens in education. You hold up a single example of a tremendous success. I'll be ready as soon as it goes off. Yeah. Tithing tutors, again, can do things in a finely tuned way, so that the computer, just because of the way it operates, can keep track of every keystroke and how long it takes you to get from one key to another, which key combinations are hard for you, what you struggle over, what you need practice with, what you would like to have more of. And with all that information provided to them, they can then give you a next paragraph after you responded that works exactly on what your problems are. The kind of individual attention to the needs of a person learning a certain skill that a teacher could never do. If a teacher stood and watched every individual student as they were beginning to teach, they couldn't garner that information from the mechanics of their typing, and yet a computer can respond to that very effectively. So those are two situations for me where computers are, again, with an understanding to the situation in which they have been arrayed, finely tuned to the need that needs to be addressed, and they do it well. Now let me give you another example. This is my, every once in a while the world falls apart in front of you. And when that happens, there's so much to be learned in just 10 minutes, because we're really skating on thin ice. So you'll notice how sometimes on the street, things will all of a sudden turn hostile, why, but everybody reacts. So it is within us to erupt when situations get slightly out of control. And we sometimes fall back on patterns we never like to admit to. And you learn an awful lot about the infrastructure that's hidden. We talked about hidden messages yesterday. One of the richest examples for me of this was once when I was at McDonald's. I went into McDonald's to order a hamburger, and I noticed the lines were long, all of them, and moving relatively slowly. And I wanted a hamburger. So I didn't know what to do, but I asked a couple questions before I picked my line, and it turned out the computer was down. So in terms of what we were talking about, the embeddedness of this technology, that's already really interesting, isn't it? I couldn't get a hamburger because the computer was down. Right? I remember going to somewhere when we were in rural New Hampshire. They had these old-timey pumps in gas stations, the kind that that would say Texaco on them or whatever, and you'd see a red cap on top. The electricity was off, and they couldn't give me gas because those pumps were just made to look that way, because when the tourists come to rural New Hampshire, that's what they want to see. In fact, you had to insert your credit card into that one just like any other. So I couldn't get gas because the computer was there. So there's a sense of need for this technology, and that is amazing. Okay, but here's McDonald's. I get in line and wait. And while I'm waiting, several things happen. First, I notice that people are still able to order because, fortunately, the cook surface isn't connected to the computer. People are still able to order food, but the kids behind the counter didn't have any idea what they were doing. So, for example, if you ask them for a Big Mac, they'd have to turn around to see how much a Big Mac costs, because That thing that used to be a cash register is now a computer terminal. And what they're doing is pressing a button.
A picture.
Okay? So, already it's interesting. There are certain fundamental things about what it means to run a business that people don't have to learn anymore because the computer does it for them. So whereas those might have been training opportunities for us, they are instead, John McKnight has called them, idiotized systems where anybody can run them because that's what serves this business. Now, it kept unraveling. I don't remember what a Big Mac was at the time, but let's imagine it was $1.59 and somebody ordered two of them. The kids had no idea what to do next because they didn't know how to handle $1.59 plus $1.59. So not only are they unable to learn about the business, there's something about the most basic mathematics that these kids, by the way, who are in a high school near this McDonald's, haven't learned. Lots of other things are happening now. The kids are totally embarrassed because they have been exposed to the public. And it isn't that they knew this stuff before and all of a sudden forgot it. It was that they never learned it and the infrastructure let them hide what they hadn't learned. What it's also hiding, of course, is the fact that nobody is teaching them. So here are computers being sort of deeply embedded in our world in a way that somehow is about the educational system to let these kids get through high school to those terminals. They don't learn a business. They don't learn even what the most fundamental thing they're selling costs, and they don't know anything about math. Now let's make it harder. The hamburgers, $1.58 or whatever I said, and I ordered two, and I figured it out, finally. And then I gave them a $5 bill. Now, most of us, I'll bet, are of an age where we learned that what you do is figure out how to round up to a quarter or round up to a nickel and then a dime and then a quarter and how many quarters it takes and then the dollar bills. Well, you understand, these are computer terminals they're dealing with. So they've got the total that I paid, Lord, having to deal with tax, 8.1%. And remember, underneath 8.1% is the decision rule. Because what if it isn't exactly 8.1%, which it can't be? Do you round up or do you round down? Okay, so you've got this really relatively complicated but everyday world math problem going on. You've got to make change. Kids don't know how to make change because typically they put in the total, whatever it might be, 258, tell the computer that it gave, because the computer, not the terminal, not the, what are the Japanese, I'm blocking, not the abacus, right? There aren't moving beads around, the terminal that the person put in a $5 bill, and it tells them exactly how much change. So you'll notice when people hand you change, if it's $1.52, it'll take $1 and then 50 and then 2. There's none of this stuff about figuring out where that came from or whether that's right or wrong. And if a mistake is made, if they press the wrong button, it's up to you, if anybody, to know that that's happened because they're just sort of intermediaries. By the way, those kind of intermediaries that are where the system can be idiotized are exactly the people who can be the most easily replaced. Right? Because it's a small step to getting some sort of cart that brings you the hamburgers after you push your own button. And in fact, did you notice this is happening now in Seattle? Now, when you go to a grocery store, you check yourself out. You put the barcode. You press the barcode and you put it in, and it figures out how much it costs and so on and so forth. So these intermediate jobs that used to be ways that people entered the business with a certain set of skills. I mean, we can think about educational systems in lots of ways, but one thing it should teach you is the fundamentals. The fundamentals aren't being taught. And it's okay because the computer system doesn't require you to have taught that. Now, how do you solve this problem? Well, how do you think McDonald's solved the problem? They buy a backup computer. Because their sense of the world is that these kids are coming out uneducated and they gotta hire them. They gotta hire somebody. The turnover at McDonald's is, how many of you have worked there? Apparently this huge proportion of our workforce has at one time or other worked at McDonald's. But the turnover is 200% a year or something, just enormous. So these kids can't get trained, they're being shoveled in and out. Right? It's getting tougher and tougher. So this may have been buying a hamburger, but for me, it was sort of a statement about the educational system and the real use of computers in education. These computers have, whatever the arguments, the Apple I was working with and the other companies, including the Gates Foundation I'm now working with, whatever the arguments you can make about what the computers could be used for, if you look, they are, as we said yesterday, monitoring secretaries to see if their production is what it should be. And they're also working in schools to help people not have to learn things that we might have thought of as the fundamentals. There was one line that was going the fastest in the job. One that was the sort of that seemed to be moving right along. Why do you think that was true?
It's management.
Age.
Management.
Calculating. Age.
There was another student, but she had a copy. So she couldn't do the math either, but she had her backup. Okay. Now think about this. You can make arguments in school, and people do, about, isn't it okay to use a calculator? Should people really be doing that sort of fundamental math when they could be learning real things? I think the argument is legitimate, but the truth is people aren't learning how to use calculators either, and they certainly aren't learning the math that's being substituted. So you can imagine an argument that says once you're fully conversant in the fundamentals of the number system, and you know how to estimate and approximate, and you know about what things cost and so on, then put the calculator aside and let's get the trig. But that's not what's happening. It's this instead of learning the number system. This instead of learning how arithmetic really operates. This instead of preparing yourself to operate in the real world. So I was really glad I was hungry for ham for that day.
Yeah.
Because so much happened. And the other thing, by the way, that I have to add, and sometimes haven't in telling this story, because it does take us in another direction, but it's a direction that is absolutely appropriate for us to think about at Holden. Almost everybody behind the counter was black, and almost everybody in line was white. And the explanation that people were muttering under their breath was race. Those damn black kids don't know how to do it. Don't even know their basic math. So the same blame machine comes into play along with the same technological apparatus. So let's have a few of those things on our plate. Can the technology do wonderful things? Wonderful things. In fact, I feel, like such a hypocrite standing up here and saying some of the things I do about technology, having prepared my talk with the aid of the internet. I probably couldn't have done that. So to get a position where I decide the answer is to deny people the technology I require is not the answer either. So it's a complicated argument that has to be spun. But at least I think for us to be on this trajectory that says this is the solution to our problems, without noticing the real world way in which it's being implemented, is really something we have to take into account.
Yeah. Another reality of that is that somebody as astute as you and aware of it missed that. I mean, you missed those pictures on the cash. And the reason I said that is because I didn't realize where we were until one day I was cleaning out my basement and threw my slide rules away. And I said, why don't we use slide rules anymore? I mean, so we've just been romanced into that awareness and wake up one time.
Well, it's the other thing is efficiency. Who's efficiency? Who's signal? Who's noise?
Right.
Those conversations that you wanted us to have got us to know one another. It hardly mattered that I don't know whether this, actually I was left out because there was an odd number of people in there. But I suspect my interviewing skills are such that I wouldn't have known whether the person I was talking to brushed their teeth by the time we were. But I wouldn't have gotten to know other things about them. So inefficient with respect to some things. Having a picture on that is really efficient if what you're trying to do is shovel workers through at whatever pace you need to, and you don't see as part of your responsibility to see that they're well educated or that they become people that can be hired as future McDonald's managers. in South Africa, and then I you gave us the example, I'm blocking now, with the vote, the ballots have to have pictures on them because people are illiterate. But in another situation where people are capable of becoming literate and where the education should provide that, doesn't having pictures only play into the likelihood that they will stay illiterate? Because they do not have to learn. And technology is often being used, so we do not have to know how to do things. I'm a great fan of the graphical user interface that Windows is and that the Mac is, but when you think about it, it's an idiotized system. It doesn't force you to know anything about computers. Now, there are certain things about computers that are hidden and well hidden and productively hidden. You shouldn't have to worry about them. But the other side of it is, I now have mostly students who, even in technology classes, who, when the first thing goes wrong, haven't the vaguest idea what to do next. So it's like McDonald's. They're doing just fine so long as everything is smooth and so long as you're letting the technical people take care of all of this for us. But what happens when something goes awry? And guess what? The history of the world is a lot of things going wrong. The other thing that, to have on the plate with all this is fidelity. What are we trying to achieve? If what we're trying to do is sell hamburgers, then we better not only have those pictures, we better have them in color. And they better be big enough where we don't even have to worry about whether people's eyesight is going bad or whatever. That is to say, if all you're trying to do is push people through, then you increase your signal in that way. But if you want to educate your constituents, if you want to have real conversations, if you want to get people to know one another, you have to think about what you're trying to be faithful to. So in high fidelity, notice this is nothing you've ever thought about. You think you know what fidelity is in music, right? Do you really? Even in music, there's a problem. Now that we have these music systems where you can have 16 different simultaneous tracks, and each one can be governed for how large the volume is and so on. What they do if they have, let's imagine, let's make it simple, 16 instruments is they mic every one of them. So what you get is the signal, the sound of the oboe, the sound of the bassoon, the sound of the saxophone coming directly from each instrument, and then they're combined. And then people think it doesn't sound real. How could it not be real? I'm picking up the oboe exactly. The reason it isn't real is because that's not what our ears typically hear in a concert hall. By the time the sound of an orchestra gets to us, it's bounced off every wall. And there are all kinds of subtle echoes that have been introduced. And they don't quite arrive at the same time. And our brain works hard to make all that work together so it sounds sonorous. That work is taken away. The sound is not as we're used to hearing it. And so in the more expensive, for example, CD machines you get now, they have what they call a D to A converter, digital to analog. They've introduced something into it which is noise in order for it to sound more like what our ears are used to hearing. So is it faithful? The most faithful version is the one with every instrument mic'd. But it isn't what we're used to hearing, and it may not be what we want. The most efficient conversation might be one where I can reduce everything to yes and no answers so we can get through this interview damn quick. But what do I end up knowing about you? And I would say, let me put that one step further. It's another set of work. Often, think about this when you get a call from an interviewer, as most of us are now, while polling and so on. And how often, in order for the interview to be completed, very complicated questions are reduced to yes and no, or on a 1 to 5 scale, how do you feel? And look at how often that frustrates you, because you want to say something more complicated to the person who's interviewing you. But they can't accept it. Their technology is not set up. They want to get it into a computer for quick analysis and to turn over the next day. But the subtleties of your feelings might get lost. So that's, for me, another example of how we're seduced by the way in which, by the needs of the technology, by its demands, into accepting the way it operates. And I don't care that much about polls, they're close enough, but I care about what's happening in schools. And to the extent to which the interests of the technology are served at the expense of what we meant by education before those computers ever arrived, we haven't made tremendous progress. Okay, now what I'd like to do is show you a brief video, and we could have a conversation now, but you know, the lights are on, and, and this doesn't take long. So let me get into this. Now what you're going to see is Bill Gates at Lakeside School, from which he graduated in Seattle. He was coming back to give a major address. And what Bill Gates says is, not in the tape, this is an excerpt, but what I've heard him say in other settings, and what I've actually heard the teachers he's talking about say is, what he wants computers to be able to do in education is reproduce the best teachers he's ever had, the master teacher experience he's had. That's what he's aiming for. So his aspiration is to make that happen. This is an example of a talk he gave about the use of computers in education in some future, at some future time. And I want you to all look at it, and then we'll talk about how, what the issues are that arise if you think of this as a realization of an aspiration of teaching and educational excellence. Okay. Now what do I have to do to make this?
Is that button on now?
Yeah.
I don't even remember putting the tape. Details, details. Now they want the tape. Thank you. Now he's giving a speech, and I've included a bit of his introduction to what you're about to see. He then does an exercise in the middle where he talks about what you've just seen and then goes further. So see what you think of this. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, turn it off.
Thank you.
Sad, nice look, Mom.
Oh, don't even start. I have a video conference later today. They can always see this.
Thanks for watching. Good night, everybody!
Everyone keeps in touch by email, but some people have never actually met their closest confidant in person. Today, partners in cyberspace meet face-to-face for the very first time. Will their relationship survive human contact? We'll talk about it on today's show.
Next.
This morning, I'm Harry Smith.
Good morning, I'm Paula Zahn. This morning, the latest on the transition at the White House. We're going to be taking a close look at the president-elect's plans for the nation and learn why she says it is time for a change.
We'll also let you check out two hot new movies, and Mark McKeown is going to show us if it's going to be hot anywhere today.
Good morning. Sorry, Harry. Bad news.
Not a pretty picture. I'll be back with the whole sad story for you in just a few minutes. Or click those buttons right now for my national forecast, or a look at your local weather.
Come on, Ian. What does this project do, actually?
Tomorrow, 5th Paris.
Jackson.
I know. So I want to get a better impression.
You know, if you just learned to plan your time a little bit better, you wouldn't have to do everything
at the last minute, I know.
Right now, we're going to look at this morning's choices for you on CBS This Morning. An in-depth look at the incoming administration. Is the first husband in line for a cabinet?
Seriously, Jackson. Are you going to be able to get this done? On time?
Yes.
Our movie editor, John Sarah, takes you to a restaurant that is actually cheaper than eating at home.
Some real theater.
I'm just dead. Or the interactive hit Jurassic Park 6.1. For years now, you've heard me talk about ways to save money by doing things yourself. But when it comes to lunch in Game Center, Kansas, you're much better off leading it to Franny. Everyone wonders how she does. Stocks up when she gets a good price. She buys big quantities.
Mom, I really need this thing for my project. You think it'll make it a lot better?
Won't spoil it before you get to it.
What do you want? I need you to drive me down to Pioneer Square today. Please? Okay, 3 o'clock. Not 3:15, 3 o'clock.
We see that Jackson is doing his last minute homework over in the kitchen. Meanwhile, his mom is using the TV set to look at a few shows. Before she walked over to the TV, she just simply made a selection on a wall panel. It said good morning, and she selected that she wanted the lighting, the security, the temperature, all the systems in the house set for her to be over at the TV set. When she got there, it simply had the rest of the show that she stopped watching last night. You don't have to keep watching a show. It just can be called up at any time. So she saw the last little bit of the late show. And then it went to her menu, the things that she likes to see all the time. There were little icons, pictures there for every one of the shows. And the ones that were where there was a new episode were lit up. And so she knew there was a new Oprah show. Looked at that for a little bit, and then went over into the morning news. And the morning news was a lot like a normal TV show. You can just sit and watch it, but it also had interactivity. On any of the stories they were talking about, you could click, just point with your little infrared pointer, click on one of those stories, and select that to come up and go into some depth on it. Take a topic like the weather. Some people love to see the weather forecast. I think it's repetitious, so I would just skip by it. And so it's very personalized how you can use the system. Now, when she was over there, Jackson handed a device like a PC, so a future PC, that he was starting his homework assignment on. And he's been asked to make a presentation on pre-Columbian art. And so he went out to the library at the University of Washington, saw what articles they had, saw a cross-reference to a museum down in Mexico, and saw some pictures that were stored on the computer system down at that museum. And one of those really caught his eye, this one in the middle here. And so he asked the system to do a search and find if there was any place near to him where he could go and buy a replica of that particular artifact. And in fact, it gave him a map, said it was down in Pioneer Square, gave him directions for him to go and get that artifact and use it in his presentation. And so this is just a very natural thing for him to be working on his assignment. Later we're going to see him come to school and see how he really does. Well, that brings us to how will this change teaching? Teaching, of course, hasn't changed a great deal. Over a long period of time. You know, somebody could say that the best teacher ever was, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, and you wouldn't have any kind of a way of determining if that was a correct statement or incorrect. In fact, it's been very difficult to share best practices, to really, you know, take presentations that other people do and custom tailor them. Well, as things move into this digital form, you'll have people posting their ideas, what they did that work, out on bulletin boards, other people coming in and looking at those, and awards being given for good ideas, and all of it easily available to be shaped for any teacher who wants it. Likewise, students can learn interactively, whether it's during the school day or at home. All this wealth of material will be there, and so they can proceed at their own pace. They can see what their level of skill is, and it will be very engaging because it will be done in a full, high-quality, multimedia fashion. Students can collaborate together at great distances, share ideas, and even people who are outside the educational system will be able to tap in to this rich material. And so in this little movie, Jackson is, of course, a student at Lakeside High School. He's got a class up in the Allen Gates building. So let's take a look and see how he does with his assignment.
He you know, he's taking a survey of this of the Bay Area schools, and computers are replacing art, music classrooms, and I think he has the right perspective. He uses his and whatever, but it's just a tool. You can't download wisdom. It's just data. It's often not very good data, and that he's concerned about going overboard with the use of them, and we're substituting that relationship between the teacher and the students, which is still most of the learning.
Any other reaction?
Maybe this is a dinosaur's viewpoint, but
I
don't know what period it is, but how would he fare if he had to go into the library of books to get the information if he was thrown into a circumstance where he didn't have access? What's the question I was asking? If it's 2020, maybe there are no more books.
It was interesting that our students, our graduate students the other day, somehow in class, or after class about technology or something, anything else, but they were, somebody just asked the question, how long has it been since you've opened an encyclopedia? And nobody in the classroom of 30 had opened an encyclopedia since they got to graduate school. And not because they had richer sources, but because encyclopedias were on the net. So I have to say, I go to the library much more infrequently than I used to. Yes?
One thing I noticed about it too, the new pads or whatever they were using for, he was using for input and to receive information downloaded on his own computer. At no place did he have to type in.
Mm-hmm.
He used point push. And I think that also reflects a removal not only from the written word, going and finding it and reading it, but how do you teach children who don't need to formulate things in complete sentences to use complete sentences? Mm-hmm. How, if you're not writing every day, if you're not writing in that, if you're not exchanging information in that form, in the written form, you know, how do you, on a daily basis, how do you practice it? How do you develop it?
One of the things that people are saying about the internet and email is people are typing more than they used to. People are having to learn to compose things at a keyboard. But you're saying the direction this seems to be heading in is
And I also have some questions about the quality of that kind of communication. I work an awful lot with children like second to fourth grade, mm-hmm. and if there's a shortcut, they'll take it. That's true with anything. And just reading their journals that they have to write at that age every day, if they're not used to saying, okay, but that's not how you say that sentence correctly, they'll say it the way they talk it. And that may not be correct English. I mean, I just said something in incorrect English, but they may do it in incorrect English. And I'm thinking about when I was growing up in the 60s, the big thing was, oh, kids don't have to learn how to spell. They can just communicate. They can just write what they feel. And we won't correct them. We'll just let them express themselves. And that was great for expression. But then I couldn't diagram my sentence to save my soul by the time I was in high school. I still can't. And
this, you said that they would be taking, the students take shortcuts if they can. This certainly was an example, I think, of Jackson taking every shortcut he needed.
That didn't change at all, that part of it.
But it's interesting that I thought, for me, the fact that there were no penalties for that, no consequences, and also no sense that we were just skirting the surface of an issue, that seemed to be perfectly okay with his teacher. I will say that the Lakeside teachers, whom he said he was modeling, were furious at this video. The people could come away thinking this is what goes on at Lakeside.
Great.
Because what goes on is depth of communication, as far as they're concerned, and thinking through an argument. Now, you can make an argument, too, that they haven't been mistaken in 10 minutes. But it was interesting to me. Remember I said earlier that education becomes what it is the computer does. This is what that's an example of. So we had a lot of icons, we had a lot of moving images, we had a lot of flash and animation. And what else was there, really? I remember this joke about Woody Allen, where he had learned how to speed read. And he said, it's taking this Evelyn Wood method. And it was unbelievable, he said, what you could do with speed reading. He said, you just open the page, and I go down the pages like this. And it's just fantastic. He said, last week, I read War and Peace in 30 minutes. It's about Russia. In the same sense, this is about the Incas. And yet, it was all that was required of this high school student, because the flash had become what the presentation was. At least you had a comment.
I just wonder how you discern if any of the information
was full of misspellings, incomplete sentences, chaotic thoughts. What bothered me about this, I don't want to get overboard, but what bothered me about this was the teachers didn't notice, because they were so busy pushing the product through, which meaning everybody had to have a homepage, everybody had to have something in graphics, everybody had to have some biography notes that they downloaded from the computer, that they didn't have the time to look at the content of what was being produced. Well, what if at the beginning of the quarter, the teacher, somebody had said to them, oh, by the way, you won't have any time to deal with the student sentences, they would have said, you gotta be kidding, we won't do this. And yet, once the technology was deployed, at considerable expense, not only to their own time, but to other things the school might have spent their time on, by the time the quarter was over, that had become okay with them, because that was how their time ended up being used. So it's sort of the level of things people aren't thinking about that are the sort of implications of the technology in place. And that there are huge issues about support, money for machines, but not for support, not for teaching not for upgrades, not for teaching the teachers how to use it well, or how to, and so on and so forth. So there's a whole, we have used up all our time without my getting to
80%. You work with the Gates Foundation, I believe you said.
Hmm?
You work with the Gates
Foundation. I work with the Gates Foundation.
Is this Bill Gates' real vision of the future?
What we just saw?
Yes. Do you think that was an accurate representation?
Well, I didn't make it on his behalf. That's their own video.
Yes.
Which they proudly deployed.
Okay.
In lots of settings, including Lakeside School. And I think, by the way, that was one of the things that worried them the most. Did we teach him nothing? is what they came away thinking. So I don't know. On the other hand, remember, he's got a huge PR operation on. They've got it. They use these things in a dozen settings, not just here. So I don't want to totally misrepresent it. I just want to use this as an occasion to raise
but
lots of issues.
The segment you had before this,
yeah,
is a very different view, I believe.
Knowledge Navigator.
Very good.
Maybe we'll use it later in the week, but I couldn't.
Just one other quick observation. I mean, I found that a very frightening tape.
Me too.
And it was frightening for all the reasons that people have said in terms of content, if that's one of the things that's supposed to go on in a classroom. There was none of that. But the other thing was what it had clearly done to the relationships among the human beings in that room. I
mean, well, and the mother and the child.
Oh, just
what was going on at home.
Absolutely. That people were absolutely incapable of having face-to-face, one-to-one relationships, Gaylord, the kind you led us through earlier this morning, without being mediated, first of all, by the machine. Kids weren't talking to each other, they were looking at the machines, and then when Jackson's came up, they were all riveted by that, but they were riveted by images and the beat. And that's a destructive classroom, seems to me. Absolutely destructive.
The kid had considered his audience, though.
Yeah,
the other kids, you know, thought that was great.
That was great. But
the music was there.
That's right. He got it.
Well, the teacher was a scary one.
No.
Very good, Josh.
Yeah.
Now, part of it, of course, could be, Margaret, we don't know where they're coming from. Maybe he'd not completed anything ever, any all quarter. But it's the sort of the social context that makes it. Yes.
Hey, no, but the impression was that she was
typical.
Pleased with those.
Right. Content. She loved what was being taught.
And yet, I mean, used in the right way, I mean, as a former teacher, you can get kids to, because of all the flash, if you require the content, you can get them to do things and learn things and be interested in things that they wouldn't normally be interested in and do. I mean, I think the problem with that was that there was no content. I don't see anything wrong with the tool. It's the way the tool is being used.
But the industry, the reason that's interesting to me is Gates going to his home school talking about future of education. And so even he and all these people are set up to be seduced.
Right.
And so this is why I want to bring us back to fidelity. What are we trying to be faithful to?
Right.
And is this faithful to the vision of education which we might have imagined? And if it isn't, how do we position ourselves in that arena?
Well, to me, it shows the absolute importance of the teacher. Because the teacher is the one that's going to make sure that they're using those things in the right way, and that we've got to make sure that we're, you know, encouraging and training and, you know, supporting teachers and stuff to do the right thing.
The training, it's very interesting for me to be in this position since I'm working with all these people, but there's training going on in Washington that we're now requiring for all teachers to be trained in technology. And it's going on at Forks and other places, and it is how to use PowerPoint, how to use animation, how to get the glitz on the screen, how to get those sounds up. There is nothing in the curriculum about how to embed this into what you're trying to teach. Because the assumption is made that that will take care of itself.
Mm.
But the evidence is not, I don't think, compelling that that is the way in which it's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Well, I just want to make an observation, my own observation. It seems to me that we are dictated by entertainment. We're an entertainment society now. And the other thing that's driving us is speed.
Right.
Why the worship of speed?
Mm. Right. Well, we got to go now. No, that's right. And so these kids were probably given 7 minutes, and who knows what else. You're right. And the entertainment industry would be delighted at how they'd certainly made their mark on this, even if the teacher hadn't.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, thank you, people, very much.
Yeah.